Hello and welcome to Noteworthy Reading, where we talk about books and authors so their ideas don't get left on the shelf. Today, we're talking about a really cool Christmas book. It was one of the first books I ever picked up where I was going to read about an author for fun and read about literature for fun. And I picked it up in my college library. I think it was in 2008 or 9 in the University of Memphis library. And it caught my eye because it says that the title of the book is The Man Who Invented Christmas. And of course, you know, Christmas isn't really, I guess, invented. You know, it's about the birth of Christ and the gift of Christ to humankind. Of course, it's Pope Julius I in the 330 ADs who kind of decreed that he thought, you know, December 25th was the official birth date of Christ, since no one tells us in the Bible when Christ, on what day of the year Christ was actually born. I was just wondering, you know, what is this book? And then I read the subtitle that it's about Charles Dickens, who wrote The Christmas Carol, and it's a story behind him writing The Christmas Carol. It is a fantastic read, and if you have any interest in Charles Dickens, just his life in a concise biography, I would actually recommend this, because it tells the story behind a lot of the other journeys that he took writing other books. So it's The Man Who Invented Christmas, written in 2008 by Les Standiford. Do pick it up. It's very good. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce you to a little figure in English literary history known as Boz. And by Boz, of course, I mean Charles Dickens. Boz was his first pen name that he chose for himself. I don't know why he picked Boz. I'm sure there's a story behind it. But the person I'm referring to, of course, is Charles John Huffman Dickens. Charles Dickens was born February 7th of 1812, and he died June 9th of 1870. So he lived right there in the 19th century. Dickens wrote over 20 novels. His shortest novel was Hard Times, but perhaps his second shortest novel, I haven't looked at everything, but I think his second shortest novel is A Christmas Carol, which in the 20th century, it's said that the readership of A Christmas Carol was second only to the Bible. Very widely read, and it's been with us for 180 years now. Many of us haven't read the Christmas Carol, the novel, but we've seen the play, maybe we've seen the Muppets Christmas Carol, maybe you've read the, I have a funny version of it here, the Politically Correct Christmas Carol, which starts out like this. Hold on. Oh no. Let me find it. The Politically Correct Christmas Carol, it starts out like this. Marley was non-viable to begin with. There's no doubt whatever about that, except for general philosophical questions about the permanence of death and the very real possibilities of reincarnation. So you might even have read this one. Not the real Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, but it's said that if we lost the Christmas Carol tomorrow, it would be able to written, if we lost all copies of the Christmas Carol, it would be able to be written the next day because so many people have sections of it memorized. It is that well known and that beloved by people who've seen it or understand the story. And, you know, perhaps the reason why it is such a great story is because Charles Dickens himself had a really kind of hard upbringing, and he grew up in a really rough London environment. At the age of 12, his father was thrown into debtor's prison. If they spent a pound too much, they'd be thrown in prison back then. That's just how it worked. And Charles took a job in a tumble-down factory on the River Thames, and what he did was, it was a shoe-blacking factory. He would take a paper... He would fill a pot with blacking ink, shoe blacking ink. He would cover that pot with paper. He would tie the paper tight, and then he would paste the shoe black ink brand label on the top of the jar and move on. And he worked next to a window for daylight. He took a break at noon, and then he took another break for afternoon tea. He would then go see his family sometimes, and then he would walk 5 miles home, get there at 10 p.m., and then go do it all again the next day. So not really an idealistic childhood for a 12-year-old. And Dickens is actually quoted, as he reflected on that experience, he's quoted as saying, "My whole nature was so penetrated with the grief and humiliation of such considerations that even now, I often forget in my dreams that I have a dear wife and children, even that I am a man, and wander desolately back to that time in my life." That quote is from page 3 of Staniford. So this experience of working in a factory as a child and really suffering from people who would prey on children for cheap labor before there were really child labor laws, Dickens was taken back there over and over again, and you see it in Oliver Twist. You can even see it in Great Expectations. You know, you have Pip who believes, you know, that he has these sort of high and lofty dreams for himself to deliver himself into the upper class, and sort of fails. A lot of that theme of someone who is at humble beginnings in society, trying to work their way up, hitting the roadblocks, the big roadblocks that were kind of placed in society for them by the upper classes, who really kind of wanted to ignore that all that was going on. Dickens was paid 6 shillings a week, and he eventually was able to pay off his father's debt, but it was a pretty brutal disruption to his childhood, as we stated before. But this is kind of inspiring, because when you think of social theories like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you see, you know, Maslow says, you know, in order to get to a place where you can self-actualize and sort of like become the artistic pinnacle of yourself, you have to have your psychological needs met first. You have to have your safety needs met first. There's all these sort of preconditions that have to happen that if they don't, you won't become a great artist. But when we read stories like that of Charles Dickens, or even Anne Frank, if you look at Anne Frank, whose diary has been translated into 70 languages, you know, she was hidden from the Nazis as a Jew, and during sort of a crucially developmental season of her life, but she produces this great work of art. In the same way, Dickens, even though he didn't work at the shoe blacking factory, and that season didn't last forever, he then went to be the understudy of a lawyer, and then was able to become a writer, worked his way into that. You see people come out of really terrible situations where they're just struggling, but they can become great artists. And it's not, I guess, Maslow's laws and some of these social theories don't necessarily determine what a person can be. They don't prove themselves out always in the lives of these great artists. So I felt like that was inspiring. And you definitely see Dickens' experience as somebody who had maybe been looked down upon and shunned by the wealthy. You see that come through in A Christmas Carol. We will continue that thought in 1 second, but first, are you looking for that perfect gift for your husband, wife, brother, sister, niece, nephew, friend, coworker? Look no further than theunforgiftable.com. Why get them something that they're going to forget next year? Get them something unforgettable, maybe even unforgivable, at theunforgiftable.com. We've done a lot of the hard work for you. We've looked around for things that are trending, for new items that have just hit the shelves that are really cool. A lot of them we've tried ourselves. And have tried to give you a shortcut to the good stuff. You can then find it there, then hop over. It'll take you through an affiliate link over to Amazon. You can purchase it on Amazon. But it's theunforgiftable.com, theunforgiftable.com. Don't miss it. About The Christmas Carol. One of the great, I guess, the harshest, most scathing critics that was around back then, who would read all these novelist books and then kind of write a review that would land in the paper, was a fellow by the name of William Makepeace Thackeray. When William Makepeace Thackeray read A Christmas Carol, you know, everyone was expecting he was just going to totally trash it. But about the book, Thackeray said, "Who can listen to rejections regarding such a book as this? It seems to me a national benefit, and to every man or woman who reads it, a personal kindness." So this was a big deal coming from Thackeray, because, you know, Thackeray's writing, and some of his readership are the upper class, who generally, you know, don't like to acknowledge the reality that there was great poverty kind of child trafficking going on in London. They kind of wanted to turn a blind eye to that. And you know, for Thackeray to admonish this and say, you know, this is good. We need more books like this. Thank you, Dickens, for writing this. This is a personal kindness to us. That was a little bit of a pushback against maybe some people who didn't really want to hear what Dickens was saying and the truth that Dickens was telling in A Christmas Carol. But let's drill down and really kind of look at some of the themes in The Christmas Carol. You know, why has this book been so beloved for 180 years? Why does maybe even just the average person that you find on the street, why can they probably quote you something from A Christmas Carol? Well, let's look. Dickens was really fixated on this idea that, and Staniford calls this out especially, Dickens was fixated on this idea that, you know, the law is very different from justice. Especially, you know, if laws are written in such a way to favor a certain class and with disdain for another class, then you're gonna have laws and you're gonna have a legal system, but that's very different from it actually being working itself out in a just way. And you kind of see this in his characters of ignorance and want. You know, you have this this boy Ignorance, who's kind of a person off the street, and then you have this character who's a girl, Want, who's working in the workhouses and basically selling her body. And a lot of that was because there wasn't really a lot of upward mobility back then. It took a lot more for people to be self-made, per se. And because of that, you know, people had a great fear of just being totally impoverished, and they didn't want their children to be impoverished. We see even in the old curiosity shop, where, you know, this old man takes this little girl in, and he tries to work and he tries to protect her from poverty, and eventually, you know, gambles it all away because he's trying to win a life savings that he can then pass down to her after losing it. And you can kind of see that desperation where people, they wanted to get out of the rut that they were in, but it was there was a deep struggle there. Another theme that Dickens does really well with is the theme of generosity coming from people who are in humble circumstances. Look at Joe the blacksmith in Great Expectations, or even Magwitch in Great Expectations, who wants to be Pip's benefactor. You know, people who are convicts and just people who aren't millionaires trying to give back and to take care of their children, and that being really at the heart of the conflict in a lot of Dickens' stories. It's no different in A Christmas Carol. People really resonated with that. Somebody needed to say that, and Dickens was not afraid to. So all these things kind of did something for the recently literate English population, because before 1800, England still had a literacy problem, but By the time the 1800s came around, 60% of men were literate and 40% of women were literate. So there's sort of this new market of just, you know, the everyday common person who will buy a book and read it. Dickens had found this market and did great work in it. Also, one thing that I kind of noticed as I was reading The Man Who Invented Christmas is that Dickens had a little bit of a strained relationship with the church, because he saw all this injustice going on. He saw a lot of catering to the upper classes and ignoring the needs of the lower classes, and he really wanted that truth to be told. He really wanted somebody to call that out, but many of the ministers and the clergy wouldn't do it. You know, they didn't want to upset anyone. They didn't want to get divisive or political. Perhaps they just wanted to, you know, work their way through the books of the Bible and not really address the needs of their time. You know, they would have rather talked about how Paul, you know, would confront people of his time, but they wouldn't confront the people of their time. They wouldn't actually follow Paul's or Jesus's example in doing that. And I think that was frustrating for Dickens, but Dickens didn't just throw out the church. You can even see in when Scrooge is sort of made whole again. There's a quote from A Christmas Carol. Scrooge, he went to church, and he walked about the streets, and watched the people hurrying to and fro, and patted the children on the head, and questioned beggars, and looked down into the kitchens of homes, and up to the windows, and found that everything could yield him pleasure. He had never dreamed of any walk that anything could give him so much happiness. So part of Scrooge's reconciliation is that he goes to church. He's kind of finally back in a mindset and a healthy routine that's going to feed the things that were dying in his heart, that had almost died in his heart, the goodness that had almost totally gone out of it. You can even see, you can kind of see Dickens' critique of the clergyman of his age in Marley's speech, where he says, you know, Jacob Marley is there in Scrooge's room, and he's telling him about what should have been the business in his life. And Marley is quoted as saying this: "Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." So Marley is trying to make it really drastically clear that making money and maybe the day-to-day grind and advancing himself financially in the world, all of that was like a drop of water in the ocean of his actual business, which was the good of mankind, and to give back and try to lead a life that would leave a legacy of giving. He missed that, and he regretted it terribly, and he's trying to take Scrooge by the collar and shake him and wake him up and say, you still have time. You know, the time hasn't run out for you. You can still do this. Don't throw your life away. And Dickens is very effective at doing this. And there's also the moment in his story where the ghost of Christmas present clearly says, you know, don't confuse all the acts of the men of the cloth with me. You know, don't confuse posturing as the church, as the actual mission and message of Christ. That really comes through with Dickens, and I couldn't help but think of a fellow who is still living today. His name is Eric Metaxas, who recently wrote A Letter to the American Church is a book that recently came out by him. But I was listening to an interview with Eric and Andrew Klavan, and Eric is saying the same things that Dickens was saying, that a lot of times the church these days, they won't just come out and confront the evils of their culture. They won't confront the killing of the unborn. They won't confront the mutilation of children all in the name of the LGBTQ trans movement. They won't confront human trafficking over the border because all these sort of issues, they don't want to get political or be perceived as divisive. They just sort of want to do church and not offend anyone, when it is really their job to be confrontational and protect people from the evils that are attacking them during their time. Dickens felt the same way that Metaxas feels today, and I just thought that connection just occurred to me while I was reading. I was like, man, you know, these guys are kind of a mirror image of one another, just in two different times, Metaxas and Dickens. So having lived in Manchester and London and gone on long walks at night and seen, you know, the scurrying rats and poor people out trying to make a living for themselves, and even people preying on children in the streets, and seeing all sort of the industrial muck on the horizon of London, the story of A Christmas Carol began to blossom in Dickens' heart. And when he was describing this, his friend, John Foster, who was a mathematician and a lawyer, a trained lawyer, he never practiced law, but he was maybe a little bit like higher up in class than Dickens. As he sort of watched the story take over Dickens, he said that a strange mastery had seized him. And this is where I really have to quote Les Standiford, because his writing really comes out here as he describes what that was like. He says that Dickens wept over the story. He laughed and then wept again as bits and pieces swam up before him, including the vision of children named Ignorant and Want, those wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, and miserable creatures who, with Tiny Tim and Bob Cratchit and Scrooge and Marley and all the rest, stamped themselves on Dickens' imagination and that of the rest of the world forever. You know, those moments Dickens had out on the street just echo into our time now. We still appreciate the story. And while we're talking about Dickens, sort of how he would just get so energetic and worked up over his stories, especially with the Christmas Carol, you can see it in his actual writing. If you go to themorgan.org, the Morgan Museum has archives of his actual manuscripts, the manuscripts that he wrote himself in pen and ink on parchment paper at his desk, you know, in 1843. It shows his actual writing, and you can almost see the ebb and flow of the energy in his muse as he's working up this story and working out in his mind and then kind of piecing it together on paper. It's really, really cool. It's amazing what we have at our disposal these days, where we can actually go online and look at these authors' handwriting and manuscripts. It's just so cool. But every page of The Christmas Carol is there, and I believe, at least from what I read in The Man Who Invented Christmas, that is the only manuscript that he had of A Christmas Carol. He didn't have multiple manuscripts. He just had one, and that's it. But you can go to themorgan.org and see that. And if you're watching via video, I'm showing you some of those, some of the pictures of his writing on the screen now. So if you open your video and rewind, you can see that in the video. But it's just so cool that you can actually look at his writing and see the passion on the page. Very cool. As Dickens went to publish A Christmas Carol, he had some previous problems with publishers. You know, he was paid by the word. He didn't really make what he should have from his stories and from his writing. And he kind of bounced around. He ended up going back to Chapman and Hall, but with a new agreement. He agreed to publish The Christmas Carol sort of just using the publication company as a printing company. He would work out who was going to be the illustrator, and he actually found a guy. His name was John Leech. He was 19 years old. He had kind of made a name for himself illustrating for a political magazine that kind of walked the fine line, the fine political line, and had some creative illustrations there. But John Leech was able to capture what Dickens was going for. And in just 6 weeks, Dickens had it written. He was still reading. He was still writing it by November 25th. He was canceling meetings with people, and he was just totally absorbed in what he was doing. But in early December, after some final edits, he was able to go to the printers with it. And one thing about the illustrator, if you watch the movie, The Man Who Invented Christmas, the illustrator's kind of like an old man. I think it's really cool that John Leech was 19 years old. Back then, I feel like people really had to achieve their life's work earlier in life while they were young and healthy and vital and strong. Otherwise, they'd be too, because healthcare was so bad and because people's lifespans just weren't as long, if they waited too long to get started in life, you know, they would waste valuable time. These days, it seems like people wait until their 30s. I did to really, I didn't intentionally wait, but that's just sort of how it happened. These days, we don't place, I feel like we don't place as much pressure on younger people to like really start digging into to their life's work. People tend to wait longer and longer. I mean, when Dickens wrote this, again, he was 31 years old. So, you know, a lot of people, some people are still in school these days when they're 31, because there's so much knowledge now to try to go soak up before you enter a profession. I love that Dickens was young and John Leech was young, and that they made a timeless piece of literature. It's really it makes me want to expect more from younger people nowadays. The book was to be sold for 5 shillings a copy, which was quite a bargain back then. If you bought a set of books, you know, it could be 31 shillings. So this was a third of Bob Cratchit's salary in A Christmas Carol. Clearly, Dickens was trying to make A Christmas Carol affordable and accessible to everyone, which is kind of part of the story. So didn't want to leave that out. After Dickens publishes the books, you know, he has to make a few printer adjustments. They can't go with as bright a red as he wanted. It was more of a russet color. He couldn't go with the gold pages on the edges. It had to be more yellow. There were some last-minute compromises he had to make just to get it out the door. But on December 19th of 1843, he actually had a problem with the printing company. They were going to put 1844 as the publication date. He was like, no, it's 1843. We're doing it this year. He got it out the door, and in 3 days, he had sold every single copy. So it vastly exceeded his expectations and his publisher's expectations, and he was able to pay back Chapman and Hall what they were owed and make a little bit of money off of it. He was hoping to make £1,000 off of A Christmas Carol when it first came out, first started selling. But after lawsuits he had with people copying it and the costs of all the printing that he didn't quite anticipate or tally up well enough, I think he only made a little over £100 when it was all said and done, even though he sold all 6,000. So I didn't want to leave this out. This was sort of, Dickens wrote a little preface for the original editions of A Christmas Carol, and in it he says this, and I think it came true. He said, "I have endeavored in this ghostly little book to raise the ghost of an idea, which shall not put my readers out of humor with themselves, with each other, with the season, or with me. May it haunt their houses pleasantly, and no one wish to lay it." I think that, you know, what he said there comes through. Every year people go back to the Christmas Carol and their heart is cheered by the story. Seeing you know, an old kind of miser who kind of hates the world and doesn't see the value in people, doesn't see the value in other human beings, to see his heart turn around and to see him go through this experience that revive him and kind of revitalize his soul is, it can kind of move the coldest among us. Dickens does that. And here, I did want to talk about, why is it called The Man Who Invented Christmas? You know, we talked before about how, you know, there was a pope in the 1330s. Oh, gosh, I'm forgetting. Julius, I think the first, in the 1330s, he kind of decrees that December 25th is the official birth of Christ, even though he didn't know and the Bible doesn't say. But December 25th stuck. And it was, you know, Christmas was sort of a holiday ever since then. But we have to realize that in Dickens' time, even, Christmas was almost like a Memorial Day weekend or, you know, some sort of, it was sort of a lesser, it was like President's Day or something like that. It wasn't the, especially these days, like highly commercialized Christmas experience with all the lights and all, you know, all the Santa and all the theatrics around Christmas that we have today the popularity of it, even, and getting time off at work, all of that. You know, people usually take a week off at Christmas. You know, it's depending on where you're working, you know, it's not uncommon. That was not the case in Dickens' day. There are even Puritans in the 1600s who you would be penalized if you were caught celebrating Christmas because they were so puritanical and they didn't want sort of worldliness around the Christian faith. Some of that even had still kind of carried over into his time. And in contrast to that, through the character of Scrooge's nephew, you kind of get Dickens' sentiment for Christmas through this line from the text. It says, and this is Scrooge's nephew talking, "I've always thought of Christmas time as the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year, when men and women seem by one consent to open up their shut hearts freely, and to think of people below them as if they were really fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And I say, God bless it." There's some that's abbreviated. There's some lines, little bits of text in between that. But if you were to take that as one continuous statement, you kind of see Dickens' heart for the holiday and see what he was trying to revive. The hope that is in Christmas, the picture of a savior, somebody who can redeem us from our sins. Dickens got that. He understood that. And that comes through in A Christmas Carol. So following Dickens' success after publishing A Christmas Carol, he wrote several more novels, but he still had a lot of financial issues. He still had a lot of family issues. He really suffered with the copyright laws, especially between England and America. They didn't respect one another's copyrights. So if an English author wrote something prominent in America, they would just print it. And it was kind of like don't tell us what to do kind of thing. And in response, England did the same thing. If a prominent American author like Washington Irving wrote something and they liked it in England, they would just print it. They didn't pay Irving any royalties for it. It took a lot of hard work to get those laws worked out, and Dickens was actually kind of a figure in that. So, whether you watch the movie A Man Who Invented Christmas or you read the book, Standiford really, he really not only captures where the story came from, but especially captures Dickens' character. You see all the love and the fear and the bah humbugs, even from Dickens himself, kind of go into the story where he conjures up this message not only to his time and place, but to really, it's really a timeless story. Anybody from any time and place could read it and resonate with it and feel a stirring in their heart from it. That is just a gift that Dickens had. That is a gift from God. And anytime, I feel like anytime I watch A Christmas Carol and step away from it, I really do feel like the Holy Spirit works inside me and kind of brings me back from my greediness, my bah humbugs, my indifference to people's hurt and need. So, definitely watch A Christmas Carol or enjoy the story this year. But in addition to that, if you're hungry for more, pick up The Man Who Invented Christmas, or the movie's really good too. I also listened to, in addition to reading it, I listened to the audiobook. The audiobook was really well done. So I encourage you to get out there. Don't miss it. And don't miss my book, Lifting with Jesus. If you go to the gym and you want a prayer for every day of the week you're in the gym, from Genesis to Revelation, from Joseph to David to Joshua to Exodus, there's prayers in here that kind of relate those experiences to your gym experiences. You try to steward your health and stay in a good mindset in the gym. So with that said, I hope you have a very Merry Christmas. Hope you enjoy this podcast, and we'll see you again soon.